For the final presentation of session 5, we have Brian Clothis, who will be giving a presentation on CubeSat frequency allocation.
Hello, everybody. My name is Brian Clothis from SRI International, and I'm going to talk about CubeSat frequency allocation today. Frequency coordination allocation is the longest part of any CubeSat program, oftentimes taking a lot longer than the project takes to build the actual satellite. So that's what we're trying to solve here today. Traditionally, most CubeSats launched have used the amateur satellite service, mostly because it's really easy to get a license and almost anybody can do it. However, if you're going to do an amateur satellite, you can't get paid to build it or operate it, and so we have some conflicts with NSF-funded CubeSats because you get $900,000 from the federal government to build your CubeSat. I wrote a paper about this and presented it at the AMSAT NA Symposium in San Jose last November in 2011. And there's the title. You can read it in the proceedings or online. It goes into a lot more detail. So this is kind of a summary of all the CubeSats that have been launched up until the middle of 2009. And you can see from the colors that most of the CubeSats have used amateur radio frequencies, with the exception of the DEPR Launch 2. And the last Minotaur won there. From 2009 on, most have used amateur radio frequencies except for the DoD CubeSats on the Falcon 9 launch. And this last Alana 3 launch out of Vandenberg in October of this year. You can see the totals there on the right. There's 62 CubeSats that are in orbit that have been launched right now. To date, 47 have used amateur radio frequencies, 3 have gone the experimental route through the FCC, 9 have gone the federally funded, the federal frequency allocation process through the NTIA, and 8 have gone ISM. So just a little bit about the NSF program. It was started in 2008 by Therese, who I don't see her now, but she's here. There are 2 goals, education and space weather, $900,000. Per award, which is not quite enough to build a whole satellite, but everyone makes it. NSF has a spectrum management department that can help either obtaining federal frequencies or obtaining amateur frequencies. And Andy Clegg and Tom Gurgley at the NSF have been helping out all the CubeSat teams tremendously. Currently, there are 8 CubeSats that have been funded. 3 have gone through the NTIA process, 4 have gone through amateur, and 1 is still undecided as what to do. There's a new call for proposals. I think it's due next month. You can talk to Therese for more information. This license summary is straight from the paper that I presented at the conference in November, so it's a little bit out of date. But you can see that about half the CubeSats are using the amateur radio frequencies, RAX 2, Firebird, and Cadre, and ExoCube is still undecided what to do. Firefly, Dyson, Cinema all went the federal route through the NTIA, and I'll talk about them in a little bit. Here is the downlink summary straight from the paper. As you can see, that most of the CubeSats, except for Dyson, Cinema, are all using relatively slow data rates. 9600 baud is pretty typical in the UHF frequency range. The only CubeSats that aren't in the 400 megahertz range are Firebird, which is downlinking on 2 meters, and Cinema, which is in the 2200 megahertz space research bands. They have a lot of experience with that band through their other bigger small satellites like Themis. Here's a little bit about the NTIA process. The CubeSat developer fills out a spectrum certification application, which just details what capabilities the radios, both in the satellite and the ground station, can handle and the modes that the radios can handle. They file that paperwork with the NTIA, and they get a certificate of spectrum support, which says this hardware is certified over these frequencies using these modes. Once they get that, they fill out a frequency authorization proposal, which details the specific frequency and the specific mode that they want to use for their spacecraft. And if there are no objections, they get a frequency authorization. Andy Clegg, as I said before, Andy Clegg and Tom Gurgley from the NSF helped the teams fill out this process. It takes several months to do. DICE and Cinema have successfully completed this process. And there's also some longer-term prospects for a small satellite group, maybe in the Space Research Service, through the International ITU. This effort looks pretty promising, but it's going to be 10 years before anything happens there. So that's a very, very long-term thing. I talk more about that in the paper if you're interested. So the NSF-funded CubeSats are beginning to move away from using amateur radio frequencies for the higher data rate CubeSats. This process will take time, and there's a longer-term allocation that's moving forward, but it will also take a long time. So we also have a CubeSat high-speed downlink communications working group that aims to provide high-speed data downlinks for future CubeSat NSF missions, and with the potential to expand into any educational missions in the future. We are trying to have this as an open standards effort so that anybody can build a radio and a ground station and join the network. We've had several meetings at SmallSat at AGU in San Francisco, and we also had a meeting last night. The meeting last night, we talked about the results from DICE, which is 2 1.5U CubeSats from Utah State University. They're using the L3 Cadet radio on the 460, 470 megahertz meteorological satellite bands. There are severe power limitations on this band, so it requires a very big dish on the ground to receive this megabit and a half signal, 3 megahertz wide with the FEC. And the dishes they're using are the one at Wallops and the 60-foot at SRI International. And those two have been successful, and they've gotten a lot of data down using those two dishes. And science operations begin next week. Cinema from UC Berkeley has not launched yet, but it's a single 3U CubeSat. They also have an international collaboration with South Korea, and who's building 2 more 3U CubeSats for launch in the future. They're in the 2200 to 2290 megahertz space research band. As I said before, they're doing that because they have a lot of experience with that from their other small satellites. And they're scheduled to fly in August 2012 on OutSat, which Travis talked about this morning. We also talked about the NTIA is clamping down on the definition of federal and non-federal CubeSats. Andy Clegg brought this up last night. And nobody's sure why this is happening, but it's been decided that if you are a federal CubeSat and can go through the NTIA process, if you are federally government funded, you are launched on a government rocket with a government primary, your ground stations are owned, operated, and funded by the federal government, and the government has tight control over your operations. The first 3 points are pretty self-explanatory. The last 2 points are very vague. And we're not sure what this exactly means, and we won't know until we try this process again in the future to try and define what exactly is a federal and non-federal CubeSat. You think it'd be very self-explanatory, but there's some politics involved, as always. The S-band 2200 to 2290 is particularly affected, and the FCC is now recommending that CubeSats file for experimental licenses, which may or may not be a good thing. Also talked about last night at the CHCC meeting was the miscommunication between the FCC, the ITU, and the CubeSats on the latest Alana 3 launch out of Vandenberg at the end of last year. 4 days before the launch, the ITU asks the FCC, why are all these CubeSats not licensed? And of course that was not true, but the paperwork had not been filed by the FCC. And so after some heroic efforts by the CubeSat PIs, the situation was cleared up right before launch and everything went as planned. The lessons learned is that each team should ensure that the SpaceCap database, which is required by the ITU, is filled out accurately and sent to the ITU well before launch. And I think I'm out of time, so thanks for your attention, and I'm open to any questions. Dave.
Why there might be some disadvantages of going with experimental licensing. Can you expand on what you think the downsides might be?
There's no beaconing allowed. So.
Is that only on. You can't beacon if you're experimental on an amateur frequency?
No. So if you have an experimental license, you can't beacon. The experimental is doesn't matter what frequency you're on. You can pick a frequency, any frequency you want with an experimental license, but you have to follow the experimental license rules. So you could pick the amateur band if you wanted to, or you could pick something else.
But they preclude beacon.
Yes. So you lose that ability for you, yeah. And it's also a experimental is also U.S. only, so you can't downlink over, let's say, Australia or another country, even if it is in the amateur radio band. Any other questions?
And there's five bullets, but you may be a government thing. I mean, it's not like you have to be all five. Any one of those, if you snip.
You have to follow all of those, all five of them.
It has to be all of
those. All five of those, yeah.
Okay.
So. One last thing, I am hosting the 5th annual beach bonfire tonight out at Avila Beach. If you guys are interested, burgers and brats will be provided, BYOB, in a discreet container. There is supposedly no glass, no alcohol, but it's okay. I have flyers. Come talk to me if you're interested. Thank you.